Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell. Joining me today is Ron Cardwell, Director of Commodity Strategy at Restaurant Technologies, a friend of the pod, the company that pioneered automated cooking oil management and now moves more than 700 million pounds of fresh oil a year through its closed-loop systems. Ron sits at the intersection of the global oil markets and what actually shows up in your fryer, which has earned him the nickname, the oil nerd, and made him the go-to voice on cooking oil in the food service industry. So, Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Chef. It's a pleasure to be here.
I got to ask first, you know, you've been called the oil nerd. How did that name come about?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say I earned it. So my entire career, you know, sometimes you find yourself in a career when you're out of college, you have no idea how you got there. And I guess that's how it is here. I went to work for an agricultural company and, you know, worked on the soybean side and things like that, and found my way into the oil processing side and just fell in love with it, right? So I just fell in love and became fascinated with how food interacts with all areas of society, how the economics of food around the world really is so important, but it also gets down to the little granular level of just you and I and your families eating out. So I just fell in love with the overall aspect of how oil touches that. It's nutritionally important, but it's vital to communities. It's vital to restaurants. I don't know. I could just go on and on. So I think just because I dove so much into it and really found just the appreciation for it, it probably helped me kind of secure that little moniker. And I do go on and on about it when I talk to people. So they're probably like, oh, that's a little much. But, you know, what can I do?
Yeah, it truly does touch every piece of the food industry, and people don't realize how much. If you're sauteing something, even if you're baking something, you're usually coating it in some sort of oil to some degree to help those seasoning sticks to get some color. So it truly does touch almost everything that we eat these days.
Well, yeah, and I try to remind everybody there's really only three components to nutrition anyway, right? It's protein, carbohydrates, and fat, and oil is fat, and it's just a vital part of our nutritional makeup, but it has such functionality that you really get this nutritionally like vital component that serves a real function in the kitchen as well too. And getting that function correct while also looking at the nutritional importance of it, I think those two really are what combines to make it kind of magical versus, you know, things like carbohydrates and proteins are great, but oil just has so much more functionality throughout the kitchen. And there's so many different ways to use it and so many different types, and it just goes on and on.
Yeah. In your role, Director of Commodity Strategy, mm-hmm. what does that actually mean on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So really it's just kind of taking a broad perspective of where oil is working into the restaurant and food industry, as well as where it works into the renewable fuel industry, which is kind of the second half of my job. But it's just basically taking a very 30,000 foot view or very macro view to say, you know, what is the availability of specific oils in the marketplace and how does that affect our supply to restaurants, meaning price and availability, right? And so I have to look at that portion first. And of course, then you nail it down to which specific type of oils are we looking at. Soybean oil is one that's really widely available, but then you get down to canola oils and corn oils and peanut oils and specialty oils, and they all kind of narrow in focus. So my job is really just help our customers for sure, and of course our entire staff understand the relationship between those macro items and how it affects our customers and the marketplace in general. So I always take a big picture view so we can narrow down onto what in particular matters to a customer at any given time.
Great, great. Maybe for those listening that have never heard of total oil management, systems or like what Restaurant Technologies does. I know I had an episode 17 you can refer back to with Diana, but maybe just paint kind of the quick picture of what you guys do with the full system.
Yeah, I'd love to. To really make it simple, we just want to eliminate the kitchen managers from worrying about what's the messiest and nastiest and probably the most dangerous job in the kitchen, which is handling the frying oil. So what we do is we deliver bulk oil to a restaurant and put it into some sort of a bulk container that's there at the restaurant, whether that be a tank or an outside storage tank, something of that matter. But we put it in, we put these tanks in, we deliver bulk oil to the tanks, run lines to the fryers back and forth, because there's a second tank that we put in as well too that takes all the used oil. So the functionality is truck delivers bulk load to the kitchen, never touch those jibs and those pourable things. It just turns a valve, fills a fryer, turns another valve, empties the fryer, and that's all the restaurant has to do with moving oil around, right? So you don't have to empty hot oil out of a fryer and put it into a tank and we're at risk slips and falls and burns, which, by the way, is the most dangerous part of being in a kitchen, is hauling that oil around, and the risks of falls and burns is huge. So we eliminate that, but we also eliminate the worry of running out of oil or making sure your oil's being used properly by saying, hey, there's the right way to monitor the quality and right way to make sure you're turning it over and changing it properly. So the entire spectrum of cooking oil, we really just want to make it as easy and pain-free as possible and improve the quality of what's being served in the kitchen to where you can just move on to something else when you're running your kitchen. Don't worry about it. We got it covered for you.
Yeah. And full disclosure, I used to be a customer and it was like the light bulb. I think it was after like 5 minutes. I was like, shut up, stop talking. How do I put it in? Because it does. It eliminates so much.
Pretty much.
There's so much you have to worry about. And especially just having the tanks there, it comes in overnight and it just plugs right into the wall. It's almost like if you're running a restaurant and you think about your CO2, a lot of places that, you know, the big CO2 containers, you don't even know when it's coming. It just comes and it fills because it's being monitored. And the next thing you know, you're like, oh, I'm not out of oil. I don't have to worry about anything. And then same thing, especially if you have self-filtration fryers, being able for it to just shoot back up through and into an empty tank. It just made everyone's life so much easier.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I think oil is one of those things you likely don't ever think about until a problem comes up, right? And that problem is usually, why is my food taste off? And then, oh, the quality's gone. Or, hey, how come we're out of oil? Nobody ordered it? Oh, no. You know, we went through faster than we needed to. Like, it's always problems that arise before you think about it. And we understand that. So we want to eliminate all those problems and make sure you have exactly what you need. So, hey, there's lots of other things going on in a kitchen that deserve your attention. We can at least get that part out of the way and make sure you have good quality, total service all the way through.
Awesome. Before we dig into some of the specifics of oil, because that's really what I want the bulk of this to be, have the 2025 impact report come out yet? I think I saw a little glimpse of that, but I wasn't sure if the numbers are out.
Yes, I believe it was just last week. We released it on Earth Day. So we didn't release the impact report. Yes.
Okay, so make sure, I'll link it to the notes, but make sure everyone, if you're listening, to go check that out. It really talks about how much is being saved and what these systems are doing, you know, on a global impact. It's pretty impressive, especially if you look year over year, what is actually happening. So I'll link that to the notes, but I wasn't 100% sure if it had came out yet.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And it is, it's good information to see what kind of impact the recycling of the oil has done and how we've eliminated waste all the way through a system from a landfill waste to making sure that everything that's used is recycled into fuel. It's the impact report is really great. So I encourage everybody to take a look at it. Yeah.
All right, let's dig in. Oil, right? Operators, they're choosing oil. Let's start there. Like you said, there's soybean, canola, high oleic, palm, tallow. Like, what are three or four variables like they need to really be weighing when they're actually selecting what type of oil they should be using?
Believe it or not, the first thing I always look at is, hey, what makes it work for your menu, right? So the first thing that everybody thinks about when they're making their menu, or rather than they're looking at their oil, is what's it going to make my food taste like, you know? So if you have a menu that's specific on flavor, make sure you have oil that, A, doesn't impact the flavor or lends the right flavor you want to your oil. So I think that's the first thing to do. Secondly is, what function is that oil going to play in your kitchen? If you have a kitchen that just has light frying, you're not doing a whole lot of deep frying, just very light, then you can pay more attention to the quality of that oil and the flavor and things like that, because you're not going to be turning over high volumes to where the cost is so impactful, right? But if you run a high fry kitchen where you're talking about constantly turning out wings and fries and appetizers, so that fryer is moving all over the place, you really have to look at how stable of an oil do we need to make sure we're not just burning cash, you know, because oil gets expensive when you're turning it over, you know, just day after day, multiple times changing the fryer, it adds up. And if you put a really expensive oil into that fryer, it adds up faster, right? So you got to look at what's the flavor impact, what's the functionality that you need in your oil. So those are, I think, the top two. And then you get down to things like price, because the price matters as well too, right? So you weigh those first two and you just see how does price factor into it. And as I said, if you're not running a high fry operation, maybe price isn't as impactful, but if you are, you still need it to function. You still need it to flavor right, but you don't want to overspend, right? So you always have to take those into consideration. And that's what we're here to do, help do, is our function as a company is to get you the oil you need and want and try to, you know, match up that price functionality too. But I think too often, it's very easy to fall into the trap of just buying the cheapest oil, right? It's very easy to trap. And I think you don't know you're paying too much for it until your food quality starts turning over, or you're burning through it faster than you really should. If you're paying half the price but using twice as much, are you really saving money, right? So those are things that we have to consider. But really, it is flavor, functionality, and price are the main considerations when you're looking at oils.
And what kind of flavors are we talking about? Because it's a very daunting thing to look at it, the list. There's the pures, then there's blends, and it gets so overwhelming trying to, again, talking about what you're trying to achieve. And I hate to say it, a lot of operators are first looking at price, but back to your point, if you're blowing through twice as much as if you were using a higher quality, then it defeats the purpose. And it's one of those like hidden costs that people don't really understand because they're just looking at a spreadsheet and a cost per pound. So what are we looking at from a flavor standpoint? Sure. I mean, maybe break some of that down. So
people
listening kind of understand which of these oils and like what kind of flavoring is actually being imparted into their foods.
Yeah. So I should say the standard of oil is to not impart any flavor at all. That should be the functionality of most oils, especially if you're frying or sauteing. You really want that oil to just function as something and let the flavor of the food come through. Okay, so your normal canola oil, soybean oils, what we call the clear oils, soybean oil in particular, they tend to have zero flavor impact. And that's great, because if you want your menu items to taste like they're supposed to taste, you don't want the oil impact on there. Okay, so a refined vegetable oil will do that. However, there's lots of menus that need the flavor of the oil. So some vegetable oils like peanut oil, for instance, or cottonseed oil, they lend a very specific flavor because the oil has flavor. And so you go down the list of saying, well, I'd love to use peanut oil. It's a great frying oil, because it is, but it's going to change the flavor of your food because it has flavor. So some oils impart flavor and some oils are just neutral. So that's really the question you have to get to. And then when you get to, you know, imparting flavor, well, I mentioned peanut oil and cottonseed oil, corn oil, and things like beef tallow, they all have very different flavor profiles. So you have to see if it's giving flavor, is it the kind that you want? Right. And so that's why I always say you have to look at that first, because if you bypass functionality or bypass flavor and just get to function, your menu will taste completely different based on which one of those choose, right?
Okay, so you said this is something that always is a question that I get asked all the time being in the industry is, what about allergens in oil? You hear peanut oil, people with peanut allergies are like, oh, I can't have that. Or they're like, oh my gosh, I have a soy allergy. I can't have soybean oil. Give the people, you are the oil guy, the what they can and can't have when it comes to oil and allergies.
The general statement is you don't have to worry about allergies and oils as long as it is a refined and deodorized oil. Allergens are carried in protein structures. And so if you're getting a fully refined and deodorized oil, there are no protein structures that are present in that oil, so they do not contain allergens. That's why soybean oil is not considered an allergen. Even peanut oil is not considered an allergen. So the oils generally do not have an allergen impact. I'll say, however, you've got to make sure you're getting good quality oil from a reliable supplier, especially when things like peanut oil come up. Because, look, it's a real concern, and I wouldn't want anybody to be overly concerned and saying, are we sure we got the peanut oil from a good supplier? Did they really fully deodorize it? Is it there? I get that. But it's if you're worried about labeling concerns, things like that, look, you just tell people what it is. But the real concern is, does it cause a problem? And the answer is no. It doesn't happen in the oil. So it's usually some other factor that hits the allergen side.
Yes, thank you. And if someone calls and asks, is there a way for an operator? I mean, I would assume, and again, forgive me for assuming, but like the big players in the game, they're probably using what you're talking about. That's not going to affect people because they have that on their radar. They keep that in mind. But if you're just calling into a restaurant to ask, you know, what questions should one ask? And then for an operator, what should they be looking for? What can they tell a customer? Because I think it plays both ways that many times call a restaurant and they're like, oh, yeah, we use soybean oil. But then someone hears this conversation and says, well, is it refined and deodorized? And they're like, hell, I don't know. Like, I just cook with it. You know, so on both sides, what should a customer ask? And then how could an operator find the information and then get that back to the customer?
Well, essentially, it's the same answer to both. Any supplier should be able to give you an allergen statement for the oil they're supplying you, which is a statement from the actual producer saying there is not an allergen present. And that's done through chemical analysis, through every testing procedure they have. So when a supplier sends that out, that batch is proven and tested and has a certificate saying it's not an allergen. It's provided to us when we source bulk oil in. We provide it to our customers to show that, hey, there is that. And so our customers, the restaurants in general, have access to those same allergen statements. So if I was a customer calling in worrying about an allergy, I would ask, do you have an allergen statement from your supplier saying that it's okay? And if the restaurant doesn't have it particularly, their supplier of oil should be able to get it to them immediately. It really should not be a very much more than a conversation, a phone call on to your oil distributor or your oil supplier, and you should have it in minutes. It shouldn't take that long.
There we go. We have settled the debate. If anyone asks me, I'm literally going to clip this, and I'm going to literally just send it to them and say, go watch this clip because here's the breakdown of it. Love it. Okay. The great seed oil debate. It's mainstream, you know, Steak and Shake's moving to beef tallow, Maha conversation, social media takes, you know, it's the oil's changing. Like, what's signal and what's noise here in this topic of conversation?
I think the first thing to look at is really there's no enemy in the oil side. Okay. So seed oil versus animal fats, basically tallow or things like that, fruit oils. It's going to be a preference side. And I think that kind of ebbs and flows. Let's just get to it. I mentioned it in the early part of our conversation. The fats are important. It's an absolutely mandatory part of your nutritional breakdown. So seed oils provide the same fat value as something like a beef tallow. So there's nutritionally, they're not equivalent, but they both fill that nutritional gap. Really what we're talking about is the origin of this seed oil debate has been around whether omega-6 fatty acids are too prevalent in a diet versus things like beef tallow. And I think there's talk about inflammation and things of that nature. And it's really marginal whether there's anything behind that. Now, some people could have sensitivities to that. Some people could feel inflammation. I won't say one way or the other. But that's been the crux of people moving away from seed oil and into things like tallow, has been a worry about inflammation. Now, the reality is, if inflammation has been shown, it's in such great quantities that you likely aren't getting it from just the oil that you're using to fry your food. Right? In general, most of the times, those oils are ingredients that are included into the processed food that you're getting. And so that's why it's only marginal relationship on whether the inflammation is coming from the oil or if it's coming from other things in the processed food side. So really, it's the processed food that probably contributes more to it than just the oil in it. Kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? But again, it's a concern. And ours is not to tell you whether you're right or wrong in that concern. It's to provide you with what you need. But there's real world implications in moving away from seed oil to tallow. But we're perfectly fine. If you prefer tallow for your menu and you think that's what you like, great. I think it's there. There's just not anything that says, you know, seed oil is a poison. Works for some people. Some people prefer not to have it. It's fine. It's functional and nutritional. It's really more of a preference than I think anything else.
What are some of those changes? Someone says, I want out of seed oils and I want to go to an animal fat. Right. What does that conversation look like? Because there's obviously pros and cons on both sides.
Yeah, of course. I think it goes back to what our original conversation was. Of, hey, do you want your food to change flavor? Because if you're using a soybean oil or a canola oil and you switch to a tallow, you're going to have a different flavor in your menu. Could be good. Could be very good. I mean, I love, you mentioned steak and shake. Look, their fries are great and things cooked in beef tallow taste great. But some things don't taste so great in beef tallow, right? So you just got to make sure it works for your menu, whether you have that or not. So that's the first conversation we have with it. And then there's just real implications on, is it available? And if it's available, at what price? And those are the things that are swinging people kind of the other direction. Beef tallow is in, it's always been around and the supply is fine, but it just takes like one or two big buyers to really disrupt the market in the entire country. Because there's just so much beef tallow available. In general, pricing isn't available more than 2 or 3 months out. So you just don't know when that price is going to be when you try to go 6 months or a year out, like you can with things like soybean oil or canola oil. There's lots of forward pricing mechanisms you can do that. So it's very volatile with the pricing. So it's a supply side issue and in kind of direct relationship to that, pricing issue that you'll have to face if you move over to tallow. Now, if we can lock that down, if you say, you know, I don't care, my customers, they want us to stop using seed oil and use something like beef tallow. You're good with the flavor. And we say, okay, well, you know, availability is tight, but here's the price. And you're willing to absorb all that. I mean, I think that's fine. I think nobody knows their customer base better than the restaurant themselves. So we will never tell you, nah, that's a bad idea. Just have to be fully informed on it. But you're really facing some price and availability issues beyond just flavor changes.
Yeah. And for people listening again, beef tallow, that's the act of taking fat that's left over from an animal and then you're rendering that down in a heat source. Sure. So again, it still takes a lot to render that down. A lot of suppliers, again, they'll use some of that fat into their grinds and things like that. Yep. When you hear an 80-20 blend, right? They're taking certain cuts and adding extra fat because fat is flavor, right? And it's a main component that's what makes food taste good. But it like you said, it's a process to render that down and then get that out. Yep. And there's only so much that comes out per, like you said, per month, per week.
And if you think about just the economics of beef tallow, this is the case with all fats, but beef tallow in particular, ranchers are not raising cattle for the fat in the cattle, right? And they're definitely not slaughtering the cattle just to get to the rendered fat. That rendered fat is a byproduct of the need for protein, right? You raise and slaughter cattle for the meat. And what meat isn't usable, that's what goes into the beef tallow industry. So it doesn't matter how much demand there is for tallow. It just won't get to the point where the prices will dictate raising a cow for the fat that it contains. So you're just limited in the supply that there is. North America in particular, we import a lot of beef tallow from all over the world because there's no way we can supply what the normal demand is. So any increase in demand obviously just means prices go up and more imports have to come in. And that's where that supply line, as I mentioned, can get disrupted, is because if there's not enough coming in, whether it be shipping reasons or, you know, demand elsewhere, we just don't supply enough in the U.S. to be able to meet all the demand as it is anyway.
What about handling, right? When it's its natural room temp state, it's semi-solid, right? I mean, it's pliable, but it's not a full-on liquid.
No, it's basically solid. It's like a big, big block of Jell-O is kind of the best consistency I can say. And I think if you think about it, you've probably seen it before. Somebody kind of wax paper unwrapping a square of beef tallow, and it goes into the fryer, and until it gets up to temperature, it just looks solid. And it has to be heated to get liquid. So the handling of beef tallow is significantly different than just pouring oil into a fryer. Now, I'll refer back to what we provide, because we do provide beef tallow in some of our markets. It's a very different kind of beef tallow. We call it pourable tallow. So it's been fractionated. Essentially, we've kind of spun out the liquid portions of that. So it is pourable at room temperature. It's a different tallow. It's beef tallow, but it's just kind of refined one extra step to be able to be pourable and at room temperature to where it's not solid. So if you go buy beef tallow, just a general distributor, they're going to deliver a solid block to you that you've got to handle. And obviously, you know, that gets a little messy, especially when you empty the fryer and put it at room temperature. It's going to coat everything in that beef tallow. It's just going to be everywhere. So there's a lot of cleanup and a lot of handling that's different, just different because it just functioned different. But that solid factor, or the fact that it gets more solid at room temperature, that's one of those performance things that's really great about tallow. Is you fry your food, and when it cools down, it's not liquid seeping out of the breaded chicken, for instance, right? It cools down, it stays in the product, it's there. That solid fat is really a matter of nutritionally, it's way higher in saturated fats. That's why it's so stable in frying conditions, right? So tallow is nutritionally different, and it handles different than what liquid vegetables oils are. But that's why you choose it, is because it has both of those things differently.
Yeah, and again, for someone's at home listening, like, I keep multiple oils, right? They have different smoke points. It depends on, like you said, what you're cooking. What are you trying to impart flavor to a product versus just keeping it neutral because you just want crispy skin on something, but you don't really want that flavor being seeped into that product. You know, you're going to use something that's got a higher smoke point. You know, so if you look under my cabinet, there's beef tallow, there's EVOO, regular olive oil, there's avocado oil, there's grapeseed oil, there's canola oil. Great. It's like, why the hell do you have so much oil in your house? It's like, well, it depends on what I'm doing, because that's going to determine what oil I need to use for, right? Again, people assume and think, you know, I just have one oil in my house. And I would say at least have a high smoke point and have, like, again, everyone wants to use olive oil. And it's like, well, know what you're getting, single source origin. And again, is it extra virgin or is it regular olive oil? Because it does make a difference. And you probably should be cooking with regular olive oil versus the extra virgin because of that smoke point. And you're going to end up burning it. And yes, unless you're slow cooking something, again, it's these type of things that people don't understand. I threw it in my pan and just started smoking and my food tasted like crap. And it's like, well, because you used it incorrectly.
No, you're saying all the things, which I think the average listener who cooks at home kind of can relate to everything you're saying, right? It's that, well, I just want this bottle of oil that I can use for everything, and that'd be way easier. And you're right, it would be. But if you use that same bottle of oil to saute something, and then you try to deep fry in it, you're going to get a different outcome. And if you use that olive oil to saute and you get great flavor, or dip your bread in it, it's awesome, but you surely don't want to bake a cake with it, right? I mean, so you're going to, depending on what you do, I mean, olive oil is fantastic, but do not include it as an ingredient in baking a sponge cake, right? It's just not going to come out, you know, tasting it right. So yeah, everybody can relate to those instances at home where you've cooked with something and something went weird and you're like, it's just oil, right? No, it's different oils, different purposes all around the kitchen.
Quick thoughts on glass bottle versus being kept in plastic. For people listening, you always hear, oh, make sure you go glass. Yeah. Have you seen or heard anything on transformation of microplastics into product or longevity going from glass to plastic?
I think the only thing, no, I don't think there's any difference as long as you're storing it in a dark environment where it's not exposed to light and heat. It's the heat transfer that probably that does more, and light degradation that degrades the oil faster. But which, incidentally, when you talk about you know, most people are familiar with the jugs in a box, the plastic jugs in a box. The entire reason they're in that box is to keep the light out, right? Because it's the light that degrades everything, not anything else. And then storing it in a cool place. So glass or plastic, personal choice, really. I like glass just because I like to be able to reuse it for a lot of things, you know, but I think unless you're putting it under intense heat or light, then neither one is going to be really bad for you.
Okay. Store your oil in a dark place. I mean, that's what I do. It's under the cabinet right next to where I cook and I just pull it out.
Yep. Yeah.
Let's talk sustainability a little bit. Again, I don't have the 2026 numbers, but in 2025, you guys recycled over 393 million pounds of used oil, and nearly 100% of that was converted into renewable diesel, biodiesel, or sustainable aviation fuel. How does that happen? Like, walk people through. They think the oil gets thrown away and then it just gets dumped out into a landfill. What actually happens with all that oil when you guys come suck it all out of that tank? What happens to it?
This is the beauty of my job. As much as I love oil in the kitchen, I'm equally in love with the idea of using that waste for something just fantastic. So the best way to understand it is that used oil is it's energy. Oil is fat, and oils are energy for our body. Well, we can change that energy into actual energy for a car and turn it into diesel fuel. You just clean it up a little bit, change a little bit of molecular structure, and you burn it in a car just like you would diesel fuel. So what we're doing is we capture all of that used oil from the restaurants. It's got no more flavor. It's been burned out. It's just not fit for human consumption anymore. But guess what? There's still energy stored into it. And so we take that to fuel processors who do some quick conversion. There's a lot more involved in quick conversion, but molecularly, it's just a quick conversion, and they turn it into fuel, and it becomes way lower in carbon intensity, significantly lower, and in some instances, only about 20% of the carbon intensity of regular diesel fuel. And the feedstock is what's considered waste. So the carbon impact is just incredibly low. So, and that's what we're really super proud of, right? Is that we make sure from the moment that oil is taken from the processors is fresh to going to the restaurant, to going to a fuel producer when it's all done, we make sure we get full use out of nature's supply of that energy. We're getting all the human energy we can use out of it and then transferring it over and getting all the mechanical energy that we need for our life. So we do that full circle supply side, and super proud of it too. Super proud of it.
Where does this category next? It's such a staple thing that really, I mean, outside of like new oils being developed and things of that, but where does this category next? You know, AI's touched everything, technology's touching everything. Mm-hmm. You know, where is it going for you guys in this space?
Well, I think we're constantly looking at consumer desires, right? It's always shifting. If you've been around for any period of time, you know that flavors change, that dietary demands change. I mean, the seed oil versus tallow conversation is new, but you know, it wasn't that long ago we were looking at saturated fats versus unsaturated fats. We look back and we say, hey, trans fats, the trans fat revolution and getting out of trans fats. That wasn't that long ago, and you're talking 20 years ago. But before that, we were looking to try to get out of saturated fats, and we moved towards trans fats. So really, We're constantly watching the marketplace, watching scientific research, and making sure we're there to supply everything. So who knows where it's going to go? Honestly, it's because it's just you're talking about human desires, and you're talking about always changing healthcare needs and science around health of fats and oils. It changes and shifts. It's never the same. It's never steady. I think probably what's going forward next is you have good crop research that says these desirable traits that we have in oils, we want to try to make sure they're there in the crops we raise. Look at things like high oleic content in canola or soybean oil, just through traditional crop breeding. And I'm not even going to get into crop genetics, but just traditional crop breeding, we've been able to develop specific seeds that grow that are higher in volume of a high oleic or a high stability oil in that oil seed, right? So those things move all the time, where there could come a time where the most stable oils out there are actually just a liquid oil that isn't even processed anymore. It always moves around. So I think that's why, another reason why I like this so much is it is never boring. But when you're dealing with human interaction there, where we just want something different, or we just kind of, we see something different, the shift just becomes so fast. You have to stay on top of everything. So where will it go next? I guess that was a long answer to a really, really simple question, right? it's hard to say.
Sounds like it's a consumer-driven type change.
Absolutely is. And this, it really is one of the real examples of not being a supply-driven conversation. It is a demand-driven conversation. If the consumers want something, the market shifts and puts it to where it's needed. So yeah, it absolutely is consumer-driven.
Yeah, I mean, everything was beef tallow back in the day, you know, McDonald's fries, et cetera. Then it went over to more affordability, and then now it's starting to make a shift back. And again, it's almost just history repeating itself over and over again, and you guys just having to adapt with what's happening in real time.
Yeah, that your McDonald's example is great. And it's really for a lot of other restaurant suppliers, but, you know, there was a time where tallow was what a restaurant used to fry in. Then the idea became, those saturated fats are bad, so you had to find something to substitute it. But you love the flavor, so you find some sort of vegetable oil that you can add a flavor to. Well, then that had trans fats in it to be as stable as what that tallow was. Well, then you get the trans fat out, so you have to get all kinds of blends of oil. You're still trying to flavor it. You're still trying to mimic it. It's great success. The industry has really flexed to what customers want. And then we kind of come full circle where customers are saying, hey, can we get some fries with tallow again? So that it really has come full circle. But again, look, if the customer wants it, if the society deems that it's proper to have this thing, fine, we'll supply it.
Ron, if an operator listens to this episode and they only change one thing, you know, on Monday when they come in, like what should that one thing be, you know, in their oil ecosystem?
I think if you change nothing else, you just need to make sure you're really monitoring your oil quality throughout the day. Don't assume that oil will just last till tomorrow. Don't assume that it's okay. You don't want one batch of bad food going out and giving a wrong impression to your customers. Really just monitor the oil quality if you change nothing else.
And how do they do that? You know, I know there's lots of different methods that I've seen, little droppers and strips. Like what do you recommend someone use?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of strips and drops, and you can look at the colors, and the best way to do it is really just, number one, trust the smell, because you'll smell when those off odors start happening. It'll start smelling fishy almost, or kind of an off, and taste your food. I mean, whenever something comes out, you got to taste the food periodically. I think those are there's lots more in-depth scientific ways to do it, but just trust how it tastes and how it smells. And make sure, and of course, if it looks bad, that's a big sign too.
Yeah, that's what we always did, is we'd always like drop something in, and if it came out in the normal cook time, we didn't change the timing, the product didn't change, and all of a sudden it looks a bit darker than normal, we're like, it's probably time to filter the oil and or change it out.
Yeah, I mean, low-tech ways still work, right? They really do. Trust your knowledge of, you're working at fryer all day, every day, you know when something doesn't look or smell or taste right.
All right, Ron, where do people go to find you, find RTI? NRA's coming up. You guys going to be there as well?
Yeah, have a big presence at NRA for sure. But anytime you can just go on to our website, rti-inc.com. It'll show you everywhere we're located around the country. It'll connect you with all of our sales folks. It'll connect you with any inquiries you might have about new or existing customers, anything like that at all. It'll be there. And you can find me the same way. I'm connected there. If you have oil quality questions or just questions about market stuff, if you're an RTI customer, talk to your sales rep. I'm happy to get on the phone with anybody to talk about those things, whether it be quality or market stuff. We're always there.
Ron, you are amazing. I love getting nerding out and sciencing every so often in certain subjects. And this was great to really kind of put the kibosh on a few subjects that have always came up to me. So I want to just say thank you so much for taking the time to jump on today. And again, as a former customer, they're phenomenal. I'm not just saying that because they're on. They truly take care of their customer. They truly have your needs best at hand and want to give you the solution that's going to help your operation. And I know it dramatically helped me in my prior life. So again, Ron, thank you. We'll link everything into the show notes. If you like this, be sure to like, subscribe, comment on your favorite podcasting platform, or you can watch a video on YouTube. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.